Thank you, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Mark Murphy, and I'm pleased to be here today to represent A1 in this case that has come up through the appellate process. Started out with the Circuit Court in Jackson County. It was appealed to the Western District, where we prevailed at that point. Then this Court took it by transfer to deal with the issue of the arbitration clause. In particular, Your Honors, and I know you've read all the briefs, and so I'm not going to belabor a lot of the points, but just to give a little bit of background maybe for everyone else and for you to see where I'm going with things, this argument today deals with a very particular issue with regard to an arbitration agreement found in a consumer loan agreement. And the arbitration agreement itself is limited to one paragraph. It's clear the parties had the intent to arbitrate, and the arbitration agreement does list a named arbitrator, which is the National Arbitration Forum, NAF for short. This arbitration agreement was entered by the parties in 2006. What complicates the matters for the court, though, is that NAF was basically taken out of the picture in 2009 by the state of Minnesota. So they were no longer allowed to arbitrate consumer disputes from that point forward. At that juncture, then, the arbitration agreement had a hole. And what we're urging the court to follow is what the Court of Appeals found also, is the very last sentence in this arbitration agreement says it will be governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, the FAA for short. And in particular, Section 5 of the FAA is what's at point today. Section 5 of the FAA provides that in the event that there is a lapse for any reason whatsoever in the naming of the arbitrator in the arbitration agreement, that a court can appoint a substitute arbitrator. And that is what we sought to have done in the circuit court. However, the circuit court took a different tack. And I will admit to the court that there is a split in the various cases across the country on this very issue. And what the circuit court hung their hat on was an analysis called the integral term analysis. And the circuit court believed that the naming of the NAF in the arbitration agreement was so integral to that agreement that without it, it failed. Our position, obviously, is to the contrary, and that the FAA was just for this very purpose, Section 5 in particular, and also by reference, Missouri has an almost identical provision too that does the same thing. When you have an arbitrator that fails for any reason, that is not available, can't serve, then the codes provide for a substitute arbitrator, and that's what we're urging the court to do today. So really the issue, I believe, is one more of policy for the state of Missouri, whether it is going to follow the federal mandate, which is to promote arbitration, or is it to take the technical construction of the agreement and find a way to invalidate the arbitration that the parties agreed to.
Well, and you hit on the key, isn't the Federal Arbitration Act? The key is what the parties have agreed to.
Yes, ma'am.
And that's what whether it's integral or not, addresses whether or not the parties agreed to have the default sort of under the FAA, or whether they agreed that just this one particular arbitrator would be chosen.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. It's a very narrow issue. As I said, too, Missouri's got an almost identical provision, and it provides the exact same thing. It's clear the parties wanted to arbitrate the disputes. That's the gist of the whole agreement. A little part of it said the NAF. Now, in one of my briefs, I gave an example. What happens if you named an individual instead of an entity to be the arbitrator? If that individual dies, what do you do? Can you say then, the parties say, if that person is deceased, we're not going to arbitrate? I think that circumvents the whole agreement of the parties.
But if the parties did agree it was just that one individual, then it would fail, and you couldn't substitute, or are you saying you could force an arbitrator on them, even if they had designated that only wanted a particular one?
I'm not saying that. I think force is a little forceful.
Well, it sort of begs the question, and I want to make sure you focus on that issue as
right.
Part of your argument. That are you saying that even if the parties have not agreed to a substitute arbitrator or agreed to go by the FAA, you know, general rules, that nonetheless they can be required to do so, or does it depend on whether or not the designation of an arbitrator is integral? And if it's part, if the latter, how do we decide if it's integral?
Well, and that's where it gets subjective, if you will, too. I think what you have to look at is the overall agreement of the parties is to arbitrate. drilling down farther, you may get to specific terms, but that's exactly what the FAA was built to cover when you have
a
failure.
What's the difference between a specific term and an integral term?
Yeah.
So if it's specific, isn't it integral?
Well, it could be. I think an integral term is something that is so important to the parties that without it, you can't go forward. But the FAA in particular, what the parties agreed to, in the agreement it says this will be governed by the FAA, so they obviously intended for that whole body of law to come in, says that if an arbitrator is unavailable for any reason, we will provide a substitute. So, yes, they did name a specific arbitrator, that entity that then was, nobody knew at the time, was not going to be able to be around to arbitrate it, but they failed. So the FAA has that mechanism and did in 2006 and does today to fill that specific hole. And what I'd like to remind the court of is your decision in the Hewitt case, I think, is really comparable to what we've got right here. In the State XREL Hewitt versus Kerr case, there was an arbitration agreement that named the NFL commissioner as the sole arbitrator. He was specifically named. Now, the court did not find that was an integral term and threw the arbitration out. What the court found is that the parties wanted to arbitrate. And they found that by naming that NFL commissioner, though, that was unconscionable. So
if,
he was out.
If we believe the integral ancillary analysis is proper, is the trial court's determination that it was integral a finding of fact or a question of law being resolved? And what deference do we have to give to that finding?
Well, I think it really is a finding of law, I think, at that, because it's a construction of a contract, which I believe is a finding of law. However, I think what it does, though, is it necessarily takes the facts of the matter and, I don't want to say twist them necessarily, but it tortures them enough to get to the result that the circuit court, I think, wanted to get to, which was to avoid arbitration. You know, it's no secret that some courts are adverse to arbitration, some courts are not. And I think that the circuit court was clearly adverse to the arbitration and wanted to find that reason. The integral analysis fit the bill, and that was the ability where
courts that have found that it was integral, federal courts, which presumably are not hostile to federal courts that have found it is integral have looked at some distinction between whether a provision just incorporated the NAF code or whether it incorporated the code and named the NAF as the sole arbitrator, as occurred here. Can you address that distinction and why you think it would not make a difference here?
Well, I can, and it's a little bit jumbled across the jurisdictions, too, and I think my esteemed counsel was active counsel in one of the cases that I've cited in my brief, which is the Kahn case. And in that case, the NAF, I believe, was named as the arbitrator, but the court in that federal case said that they could be substituted per Section 5 of the FAA. So
how would you make it integral if you wanted it to be, and how would you make it not, or how should we interpret silence?
Well, what I would do, Your Honor, is...
What does one need to do?
Well, that's kind of why I'm substituting myself in there. But what I would say is that the integral analysis I don't really believe is appropriate. And the big reason it's not appropriate is it takes arbitration agreements out and treats them specially away from other contracts. The law is pretty particular, which says that an arbitration agreement is to be construed just like any other contract. But if you look at the course of the law, especially cited by my opposing counsel, all of the courts that are finding this integral analysis only do it to arbitration agreements. So they're treating them in a special class, which frankly is against the common laws of the
country. And you think courts nonetheless enforce contracts and substitute terms, even if some terms of the contract, other terms of the contract fail, courts will substitute their own terms?
No, I don't think so.
Or is that how we treat all essential terms of a contract? The contract fails if some essential term fails.
Well, I think the distinction here, though, is arbitration is a little bit of a special animal because you've got the FAA that says in the statutory scheme, and the Missouri statutory scheme follows it too, that if this particular term fails, then the statutes, the legislative provisions, provide a remedy for that situation.
So that gets back to my first question. Even if the parties did not intend to have a substitute arbitrator, you would say they have to accept one, What about then the United States Supreme Court saying arbitration is a matter of agreement, and unless something's expressed in dealing with class actions, for instance, we cannot enforce it?
You're right, and that's frankly the difficult part of this, but I think you really hit on that. I think in what the legislative body has done, has said that you can have these arbitration agreements, But if this provision fails, and it's specifically addressed by Section 5 of the FAA and by Section 435.360 of the Missouri statutes, if an arbitrator fails, we will substitute. So the parties know that going into it. It's not a surprise term. You can agree to anything under the law that's not against public policy. But if legislatively it says these are the parameters, that's what people have to work within. So I think, Your Honor, to answer your question, maybe in a very roundabout sort of way, I think to an arbitrator to be substituted, yes, I think that can be forced on them, for lack of a better word.
You would imply it as a term of the contract as a matter of law, whatever they
would have agreed to. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And bouncing back, if I could, too, I mentioned the Hewitt versus Kerr case. Again, I thought that was a really applicable case to the argument here. This court found that it was unconscionable for that arbitrator to serve. The parties had specifically agreed that the commissioner would be the arbitrator.
But did we engage in the integral ancillary?
It was not.
Dichotomy there? No.
No. Right. That was not engaged in at all. What the court found is it was unconscionable. He was out, so they appointed the substitute in. And frankly, if it drilled down to the NAF, the NAF was an industry arbitration forum, if you will, for the consumer finance industry. And that was the reason why the state of Minnesota got rid of them in the first place. So if you could take that as an analogy, their role as an arbitrator could be unconscionable as well. If I was arguing on that side of the case, that's probably what I would have said, that the NAF could have been unconscionable. In that case, put it on a parallel with Hewitt, put the NAF out, you put a substitute arbitrator in, and the parties proceed with the arbitration that they agreed to do. So basically, Your Honors, in sum, I would ask the court to follow along with what the Court of Appeals ruled and find that the Section 5 of the Federal Arbitration Act provides for a substitute arbitrator in these circumstances and reverse the circuit court. Thank you, Your Honors.
You'll have time on rebuttal, counsel.
If it pleases the court, my friend says that there's a split among the authority around the country. So that's only true to a part. So there's about 20 cases that look at language very close to the language in this contract. And so first of all, there is no split on what the standard of law is. In the Kahn case that I lost, and then all the different cases my side has won on this issue, and the other cases our side lost, and the cases are distinguishable, all the federal courts, every state Supreme Court, and every state appellate court that has looked at this issue has applied the test of, is it integral to the agreement? That is unanimous and a consensus rule. There's not a split on that.
Even the Seventh Circuit?
Yes, the Seventh Circuit. I mean, I think that, so they cite this, so Judge Easterbrook cites the integral analysis, although I do think that what he then does is he essentially applies not only the sort of a policy in favor of arbitration, but he applies essentially a presumption in favor of the drafter, where he says, well, I'm sure that this company wouldn't have wanted to be sued in a class action, so we'll figure out a way to write this contract to work it. So, I mean, I think, but even if you look at the Seventh Circuit case, a subsequent Seventh Circuit case, that's the Green case.
Yeah, so they really didn't apply the integral ancillary.
Well, I don't think they denounced the test. They gave names because I don't think they applied it fairly.
Right.
But then in a subsequent case, the Jackson case, which is a case involving one of these fake Indian tribal arrangements that some payday lenders have gotten in trouble with. So they threw out the fake Indian tribe arbitration service, and then they looked at and compared, well, what happened in Green, which is the case that you referenced, Judge Easterbrook's case. And what they said was that in Green, all the arbitration clause says we had to follow the NAF rules, but it didn't say who the arbitrator had to be. It didn't specify who the arbitrator was. So therefore, I think what the court was thinking was that in Green, you were thinking it was like the American Arbitration Association, where it's very common for companies to write clauses where they use the AAA rules because they have a bunch of due process protocols and so forth and protections, but then they don't want to use AAA arbitrators who tend to be expensive. And so that was what they were drawing a distinction, saying Green doesn't apply here, because in this case they threw out the entire clause in the Jackson case, which is later than the Green case. And the reason was that in Green they only named the rules, but they didn't name the arbitrator. In this contract, it explicitly names both the National Arbitration Forum rules and the National Arbitration Forum as the arbitrator. So this case is different from Green in that respect. But I think that if you look at the case, the Second Circuit case Moss, the Third Circuit case Kahn, there are four cases from the 11th Circuit. There's Supreme Court cases from Illinois, the Carr versus Gateway case that's cited in Judge Witt's dissent. That's actually a particularly good case for us. The New Mexico Supreme Court and all the other state intermediate court of appeals from Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, I'm forgetting some. They all use the integral term point. And the reason the integral term point is appropriate, that test is appropriate, is it's the only way that you can make Section 5 of the Act consistent with Section 2 of the Act. So what Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act says is that arbitration agreements are supposed to be enforceable. And the U.S. Supreme Court, when they talk about their policy in favor of enforcement of arbitration, they put a nuance to it. It's not that you just force anyone into any kind of arbitration. You have arbitration according to the manner provided in the agreement. So we cite the Volk case, for example, and then a series of other U.S. Supreme Court cases that say the policy in favor of arbitration as it's provided in the agreement by the terms of the agreement. And sometimes there are limitations on that. So, for example, in the Volk case itself, the normal rule is, so there's a case where some of the issue is supposed to go to court and some of the issue is supposed to go to arbitration. And the normal federal rule is you always do the arbitration part first, because whatever the arbitrator finds is going to end up governing what the court does, and the court's going to follow it, and also the case frequently settles. So you go arbitration first. California rule is different. California rule says you do the court part first, and then you go to arbitration. What Justice Stevens said for the U.S. Supreme Court in Volt was, and so the defendant comes in and says, oh, we're being repressed, the Arbitration Act's being ignored because we're going to be forced to go to court first, and we wanted to go to arbitration first. And what the Supreme Court said was, no, you wrote an arbitration clause that picked California law over federal law. So even if that's anti-arbitration, because you're going to end up going to court first and the court's going to end up resolving it, since you wrote a clause, you have to follow the terms of the clause that you wrote, and you're stuck with it. And even if that's anti-arbitration, so be it. And Justice Stevens went on to add, in a subsequent case, Master Buono, that you interpret these contracts against the drafter, who's the one who drafts the contracts. And this is certainly a case, you know, we're talking about a payday lending case in which they are completely the drafter, and the difference in parties is unbelievable. You know, our client borrowed $300 and they sued her for $7,000. So this is a case in which the policy in favor of interpreting against the drafter is powerful. There are subsequent cases from the Supreme Court also that go on, though, and say that the pro-arbitration policy doesn't operate just in a vacuum without regard to the interests of the parties. So you look at what the parties are trying to say. And so what the cases that we cite and the cases that they cite that interpret the integral to the term analysis all turn on the language of the contract. They look at the language of the contract and interpret it. And so, but if you follow my friend's approach, I think Justice Stitt's point is exactly right. You're going to be forcing people into arbitration where the integral term, the guts of what they really agreed to, went the other way. That's going to put Section 2 of the Act in conflict with Section 5. And the only way to read them together is to read Section 5 as having this integral term exception.
So would you say that whenever you name a specific arbitrator, then that is an integral term, or is that a fact question?
So I would say that it turns on the language of the contract, and it goes a little bit. So just naming an arbitrator alone, I think nearly all the courts have said that is not enough. But there's some things that go further. So first of all, most arbitration clauses have a severance provision that says if something here falls out, the rest of you enforce the rest of the clause. This clause does not. Second is that many arbitration clauses will provide a list of several different arbitrators. So during the mid-2000s, you saw a lot of arbitration clauses that would say you have a choice of the AAA, JAMS, which is former judges, or the NAF. But this also, a lot depends on whether they use mandatory language. So this contract, so I've got the arbitration clause here, and it says any disputes shall be resolved by binding arbitration by the National Arbitration Forum. And that shell language has been picked up on by the New Mexico Supreme Court in the Rivera case, which our firm handled and won, the Caridio case from the federal district judge in Seattle, and a whole raft of the subsequent cases. The Second Circuit case from just 2 years ago agreed with that. And then there's been a bunch of cases from the 11th Circuit, which we cited in our brief. So they're right that the original case in the 11th Circuit that first enunciated the integral term case found that the integral term test hadn't been met. We put in our brief, I know it's in the footnote, but we went back and looked on Westlaw and we found the briefs. The defendant came in and said, well, rewrite the arbitration clause, and the plaintiffs didn't even respond to it. So they didn't even make an argument that it met the integral term test. There was no effort to even put forward any argument there.
What would be the harm in just selecting another arbitrator? I mean, is this just a way to avoid arbitration?
Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
What would be the harm in just selecting another arbitrator? Is this just a way around avoiding arbitration?
No, Your Honor. What I would say the harm is that it's not giving meaning to the intent of the parties, what the parties really agreed to here. I think that the harm is that then you have something that the parties didn't agree to that goes.
But didn't they both agree to arbitrate?
What?
Didn't they both agree to arbitrate?
They agreed to arbitration that it shall be by the NAF under the NAF's rules. And I think that that's different from agreeing to arbitrate in general. There are a lot of contracts that say the parties agree to arbitrate, and you can meet and see what you can agree to, and if you can't agree on something, the court will pick. And here they pick that it shall be by the NAF rules, which a number of both federal and state courts have said that shall by itself does it. But also, we put in the record here the NAF rules, which I think go a lot further to showing, to meeting the standard of evidence that you're talking about, and I think that show that this is different. So if I can take the NAF rules, and it's at LF224. And so rule one, so it's not like it's hidden deep in the rules. Rule one of the NAF rules in A, the last second. This code shall be administered only. So the only is exclusive language. Only is language saying this is NAF only, no one else. This code shall be administered only by the National Arbitration Forum or Forum. Now that's, first of all, that's really different than AAA or other arbitration providers. And when my friend candidly admitted that the NAF was an industry forum, that's really right. I mean, we put in quite a bit of evidence, both from government proceedings and whatnot. The NAF was corrupt. They were shut down by a law enforcement proceeding. They were sued on a Friday, and they shut down their operations on a Sunday. They were engaged in double dealing, where they were on both sides of the same transactions. And they were being frequently selected by predatory lenders in particular because of how they were ruling in case after case. And there's a lot of evidence that the selection of the National Arbitration Forum, they didn't just fall from the sky or someone picked this up, a flyer off the floor. They were aiming and targeting and marketing to people, and their selection wasn't an accident. And that language should be given meaning. And so about the language I just read, by the way, the Illinois case that I cited, that I referenced, that's in Judge Witt's dissent in the Court of Appeals, the Carr versus Gateway Computers. That case in Illinois Supreme Court made a significant point out of this language in the NAF rule. They quoted the same language I just read to you and said that this militates strongly in favor of a finding that they are an integral term. Now, there was another sort of idiosyncratic term in case in the term in the contract, because these really are contract-based language, but they did take that exact rule that I just referenced. Also, the fact of the NAF rules was a significant feature of the New Mexico Supreme Court case, the Rivera case. And what they looked at was that the NAF rules talk about themselves more than anyone's ever talked about themselves. They have rule after rule, which not just says, you know, you're going to have this sort of thing, but they cross-reference themselves. There are all these different references to the National Arbitration Forum, and the multiplicity of references to themselves was one of the factors the Rivera court said.
So, can you address opposing counsel's argument that we can imply an agreement to have a substitute arbitrator by the fact that the FAA and the Missouri counterpart both provide for substitute arbitrators?
So what I would say is the language between Section 5 and the Missouri statute are a little bit different, and the Missouri statute is somewhat broader. To the extent that my friend is suggesting that you can imply that you can send someone to arbitration where the integral term is to the contrary, then I think that violates Section 2 of the Act, which is the most important, the operative part of the Act. Justice Scalia, in the Concepcion case, called Section 2 something, I can't remember the exact language, like the heart or the core of the Federal Arbitration Act, and agreement being the central point. And I think that if you say that you can imply as a matter of law, without respect to what the contract language says, without respect to the actual manifested intent of the parties, you can imply an agreement where there's not an agreement, no, I think that violates the Federal Arbitration Act. I think that that's the exact reason why court after court have interpreted Section 5 as having this implicit exception. So Section 5 says you can imply, you can substitute an arbitrator, except where it would run counter to what the parties had agreed. But let me talk about the Hewitt case, if I can. So this court, so far as we can tell from the briefing, never had the integral term issue addressed to it, and there wasn't any particular language that said only the commissioner or shall or what. You know, there was no discussion of the language of the contract, but the issue of is there a conflict here between enforcing the arbitration clause or throwing it out was not raised or briefed. And I think that that's, you know, that the parties, for whatever reasons, and they could have a million reasons, I could guess, why both parties in that kind of situation. I can imagine a super wealthy professional athlete not wanting to be in front of a jury, or maybe, you know, you can't tell. But in any case, this court never faced the issue, and I think that
it wasn't an NAF case; it was a AAA case.
It was the NFL commissioner, so an N and an F, but different third letter. I think that this, to have this court say we're bound by a decision we made in a case where an issue was never briefed, and no one told us, the Second Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit three times, all these other state Supreme Courts have gone the other way. I think that's limiting this court very sharply in a way that I think is not.
Let me interrupt. Are you arguing that the arbitration agreement is invalid for failure of an integral term? Or are you arguing that the arbitration agreement, properly construed, extended only to arbitration in front of NAF, and if NAF is not around, then there was no agreement to arbitrate?
The latter, Your Honor. Okay.
Is that consistent with the integral ancillary dichotomy?
Yes, absolutely.
So some of those decisions talk about validity, or suggest they're talking about validity, as opposed to purely enforcing the agreement of the parties.
There sure are a lot of cases, but the vast majority of them, I think, are following the integral versus ancillary test and saying that where an integral term was the particular named arbitrator, and that arbitrator has gone out of business, is to say that you can no longer enforce this clause, and the clause drops. And one thing that's interesting is that
you're talking about validity now. You're not talking about enforcing the clause properly construed. And that's my question.
I'm sorry if I'm slow on the uptake here, but I thought you drew a distinction between validity on one hand and then applying the integral test to say that where it specifies a particular entity and that entity has gone out of business or is no longer handling, that you apply the integral test by not enforcing the arbitration clause and sending the case to court. And I was trying to check box two and say that I was agreeing with the second part, because that's where I think all the cases on my side go. I'm not aware. I mean, I think validity gets there are contract arguments about failure of purpose and so forth, and I don't think that those arguments work very well. I think that the statutory argument that the Second Circuit and the Fifth and the Eleventh Circuit,
I think the question is, are you saying they only agreed to arbitrate before this particular body, and so the arbitration agreement simply doesn't apply here because it only applies in situations where that body's available? Or are you saying an essential term of the arbitration agreement failed, and therefore the arbitration agreement, which otherwise was broad, fails? It comes to the same thing, but they're two different conceptual.
So if I'm following you, Your Honor, I believe I'm saying the first. I think that's the line that the cases that I'm citing follows. They'd agreed on a particular entity, it's gone, and so now the case has to go to court. I hope I'm following you.
That's fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor, if it pleases the court. I've just got a few highlights, if you will, that I'd just like to hit here, and then if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those. My learned counsel referred to what the guts of the party's agreement was. I think that it is evident that the guts of the party's agreement was to arbitrate. And looking at the arbitration agreement, it does say shall. You know, there's no parsing around that word. But I will point out it does not say shall be exclusively, which many of the cases cited will look to.
Well, what about the language opposing counsel referred to that says it has to be under the NAF rules and only an NAF arbitrator can apply these rules or can apply the code? Why doesn't that indicate if there's no NAF arbitrator and they're the only ones who can do it, that fails or doesn't come into application?
Well, I think it does fail. I think you're right, Judge. And again, it gets down to when you're looking, as you were saying, Your Honor, about the validity of it or not. And I think, again, it is on a great parallel with that Hewitt case, because in that case it said shall be that the NFL commissioner who shall do a final non-appealable binding decision. The court found that unconscionable. If the NAF is here and they've got their rules that have to be followed, and they, as I admit, were an industry stooge, if you will, it would be unconscionable. Same result should happen.
Are you giving any meaning to the word only in there?
Pardon me?
Are you giving any meaning to the word only in the contract?
I am giving some meaning to it, but actually I would bounce back and get back to what I talked about with the legislative intent, basically. Mm-hmm. It's obvious from the legislature that they intended that there, and they foresaw that there could be a circumstance where a named arbitrator wouldn't be available. Either they passed away, the entity didn't exist, and so on. Parties know that going in. That's what happened here. NAF was unavailable for that, for the reason that the state shut them down. They could have went out of business. Does that mean the parties don't want to arbitrate? I don't think so.
Well, your opposing counsel, excuse me, I'm sorry. Your opposing counsel talked about Section 2. How does that apply? What's your response to that?
Well, again, the Section 2 talks about enforcing the agreement as a whole, and I guess it'll go down to how far you're going to drill down to try to construct a way to say what the parties agree to. The parties agree to arbitrate. I think that's a given. Do the parties then say only if it's these people? Well, it doesn't use the word exclusive. It doesn't say only be these people. It says shall. So there is a lot of case law. We've cited that in our briefs, too, for other courts that have said if it doesn't say exclusive, if it gives some leeway, then there's obviously some intent there that other people could come in. Then I would tie it to Section 5. You have to give credence to the whole statutory scheme, just as you have to give credence to the whole arbitration agreement. So do you make it fail because that term that the legislature foresaw could fail doesn't work? I don't think so. I think you're compelled to name a substitute arbitrator and let the parties go forth with the arbitration they agreed to. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Fine argument by both sides. Case will be taken and submitted.